Alright, hello everyone, and welcome back to episode 3 of our new season of Safari Stories. Our dog is here with us, so if you hear some sniffing on the mic, it's because he's
wandering around.
Very intent. I think we're going to spend this episode talking a little bit more about the actual experience of heading down to Antarctica.
Yeah, getting on the boat.
Exactly. And right there, I'll stop you and say that everyone on the boat will tell you it's called a ship.
Sure.
most importantly, the captain of the ship. Yeah, I've made that mistake in the past.
It's not a boat.
Yeah, and they get offended if you say boat.
I'm sure they do.
This is a ship that goes into some of the most
intense seas
on the planet. So I think we'll start by saying and talking about what it entails actually to get down to Ushuaia itself. And it's quite simple. It's it's called Fin del Mundo, so the end of the world. Apologies for my Spanish accent. But you fly via Buenos Aires, and it's roughly a three-hour flight down south. And it's quite a nice flight, especially the last bit of the flight down to Ushuaia itself, because you approach the airstrip or the airport through the Beagle Channel, and that's because it's the only part, it's the only area around Ushuaia that's flat enough to land a plane. So you come in over these quite impressive mountains, and it's the very southern part of Patagonia and the very southern part of the Andes. And you kind of come over these snow-capped mountains, and then you fly in through the Beagle, and you're kind of surrounded by these mountains. So you have to your north, you have Argentina, and then to your south, usually to the left when you're flying in, is Tierra del Fuego, which is part of Chile. And then Ushuaia is this lovely little, it's quite a quaint town that really retains a lot of its Argentinian character. You can almost call it a city now. I would liken it to sort of a cross between a ski town.
I was going to say a city. That surprises me.
Yeah. It doesn't have a city-like feel, but just in population, it's grown a lot in recent years.
What's the population?
It's about 50 to 60,000 people, as far as I know.
Is most of that, like, industry related to tourism?
Yeah, I would say the vast majority of that is related to tourism. They do have a small naval base as well in Ushuaia, but no, the vast majority is tourism. There are a few fishing vessels that are usually in the port as well. But just given how much Antarctic tourism has grown in recent years, COVID aside, it's facilitating the amount of tourists that come into town.
And most people are spending a night there before the
ship
departs.
Yeah, that's correct. And there's actually lots to do in the vicinity of Ushuaia. What I really enjoy doing when I have a half a day there or a day there is going up into the mountains, which are just behind town. Really easily accessible. Like, you can walk to the starting point of a lot of these hiking trails that go up to, there's a glacier called the Marshall Glacier or Marcial Glacier. And it's just gorgeous because you very quickly gain elevation. You can get above the tree line really quickly.
I was going to say, Ushuaia is at sea level.
Yeah, Ushuaia is at sea level. Yeah, it's a port.
Yeah.
And then you really have a lovely view of Tierra del Fuego to your south, and good opportunities to see, you know, good wildlife, especially good bird life.
Well, I was going to say, and if you're not up to hiking, although we always say that's a great way to shake off jet lag if you're coming from a different time zone, but I'm sure the birding just in the harbor is good.
Yeah, the birding in the harbor is good. There's lots of different duck species, goose species. There's waders.
Do you get condors down there?
Yeah, you do. You see condors when you go into the mountains. You sometimes see them from the port. You see turkey vultures.
Classic.
Yeah, there's a little like nature.
Kind of like the pigeons of the raptors, turkey vultures.
Sure.
Like, they're everywhere.
They are all over. Yeah, right. They're all over the place. Their distribution is all over the Americas. That's for sure. But it's just a nice city to spend a day or two in before going on this trip. And as Hadley said, it's great to shake the jet lag.
Make sure you make it there. I will say, just from a logistics point of view, I feel like a good number of people probably spend a night or two in Buenos Aires at the start. And then, but not necessarily, I mean, I would always recommend that because you just never know what happens with your international flights. Nice to have a little bit of a cushion in there, and nice to, again, have a little bit of a cushion in Ushuaia to, make sure that you make it onto the ship, in time.
Yeah.
But that also being said, when I most recently landed in Buenos Aires, there was a Delta representative when you get off the gangway with a sign for Ushuaia ushering people, anyone that was going to Ushuaia.
Oh, really?
Yeah, to go right along. Real FOMO. I really wanted to follow
her.
Yeah,
I'm sure. I'm sure, yeah. So Hadley was in Argentina, but she did not come and visit me.
Yeah.
Maybe this year.
Yeah, hopefully.
But normally the passengers, the guests, board the ship in the early afternoon. And the ships generally don't depart in the early afternoon. We did a couple of times this season for a couple of reasons, to get a good weather window to cross the Drake. But there's also a few other factors involved. Generally, what you do when you board the ship is you check in and you go, you get your stuff down into your cabin. And then there's a couple of briefings and drills, lifeboat drills, that have to happen before the ship is actually legally allowed to set sail. So the lifeboat drill would be a mandatory that happens quite close to the beginning, where you kind of are told what would happen in the very unlikely scenario that, something
happens.
Yeah,
it's like a fire drill.
It's like a fire drill. It's kind of like your briefing when you get on a plane first, right, where they tell you what to do with the life vest and things like that. And it happens on every trip. It's very short, and it's interesting and informative. You know, I think a lot of people may have been on a ship in their lives, but maybe not everyone's been on a cruise, and certainly not an expedition. So there's a lot of new information to take on.
Just on that note, what are the sizes of these boats? What are we talking? Cruise, I feel like when I think of a cruise ship, I'm thinking like 1,000 plus passengers.
Yeah, I think the real difference between a cruise ship and an expedition vessel is the size. The cruise ships, some cruise ships go down there, but if you're on a cruise ship, you're not leaving that ship. The expedition vessels are built
as a home base that you leave.
Exactly. They're sometimes modified from other types of ships. Sometimes they're completely purpose-built for these expeditions. But the idea is that you are able to leave the ship in these very extreme conditions and environments and explore, in this case, Antarctica itself, or
Also, I mean, the smaller ships can get much further south.
Right, exactly. So they can get further south, kind of deeper into inlets and channels and ice a lot of the time. There is again a legal requirement or a law that says you can only have 100 people that go on shore at any given time in Antarctica at a landing site. And generally what that means is that most ships that go down there, most expedition ships, don't have a capacity for more than 200 guests. And none of the ships that I worked on have a capacity for more than 200 guests. And the one that I was on this past season, the Ocean Adventurer, can only have 130 guests, which is a really, really nice
size.
Yeah. All the guests are able to leave the ship at the same time. And I'll get a little bit more into that later on.
We digress.
Anyway, so you start to set sail usually in the kind of mid-afternoon, call it 4 or 5 o'clock or so. Obviously, it's bright. These trips go from the start of the austral summer, so the start of the southern hemisphere summer, which is kind of the very end of October and start of November. So it's very bright there at that time of year already. It kind of stays bright till 9 or 10 in the evening in Ushuaia. And they go through to the end of March, mid to late March, which is when it kind of turns to winter again. There's not that much of a spring or fall down there, but so you find that the light very quickly changes, and the conditions and the temperatures really quickly change as well.
So that time of year, say that the season's starting in October, end of October?
Late October,
Is the sun setting?
Yeah, in Ushuaia, the sun is always setting, and kind of mid-December when it's the summer solstice down there.
Like 10:30,
it'll probably still be bright at 10:30 or so, but it does get dark, and it gets fully dark. It's not like just twilight. But when you set sail, you go through what's called the Beagle Channel, and we talked, the Beagle is named after the ship of Darwin, who did explore that area down there, and the Beagle Channel is this very, very narrow channel that separates Tierra del Fuego and the mainland of South America. Mm-hmm. And you spend 2 to 3 hours sailing through this channel, and it is a
I feel like I've seen videos of that at sunset. The sun setting over the mountains, it was very pretty.
Yeah, I mean, if I think about, like, we usually finish all of these drills, have dinner, and then we do kind of fitting people into their boots and their clothing that they're going to wear down there, which is another important thing that I guess we should mention at some point. But you usually have the opportunity in the evening to go out and really, as a guest, you always have the opportunity. But when you're working, you know, you don't necessarily always have the opportunity to be outdoors because there's a few things that you have to do on that first day. But you go to the outer deck after dinner and, you know, you really get the opportunity to start seeing some of the wildlife that's in the Beagle Channel.
La la.
And there's a lot of it. Yeah. So you start, it's like nice because it's still very calm and it's the Beagle Channel is flat. So you're not feeling the motion of the ocean whatsoever.
Kind of wildlife are you
You start seeing you start seeing penguins already. I've seen various different penguin species, but the one that you see there that you won't see down in Antarctica is called the Magellanic penguin.
I did not know that.
Yeah, did you know?
No.
Yeah. It looks really similar to the African penguin jackass penguin.
I know what that penguin looks like. I've seen it in an aquarium.
You know, so that family of penguins is called either the jackass penguin family or the tuxedo penguin family because they look like they're wearing these little black and white. These very black and white penguins. And there's a colony of Magellanic penguins that you go past. It's at a distance, but with binos, you see them on the shore. They breed quite early in the season because that part of South America is ice free quite early in the season, and you see them in the water as well, you start seeing lots of different birds. So just like 20 to 30 minutes after leaving Ushuaia, you might start seeing black-browed albatross already, which breed in Tierra del Fuego, which is really cool.
Maybe do you want to give a little info on what pelagics are, because I'm sure we're going to refer to birds as pelagics
times. Absolutely, yeah. So you start seeing pelagic species of birds, and pelagic species are species that spend the vast majority of their life at sea. And I like to say they make a living on the on the open ocean. It's where they...
Too true.
Yeah, it is, because it's where they feed, right? They are feeding there. You start seeing them in the Beagle Channel because a lot of them breed on Tierra del Fuego, or on that archipelago, and generally speaking, pelagic birds will breed in areas where there are no large terrestrial mammals or predators. So albatross, while they're very large birds, they have bred in islands where invasive species like rats and rodents have been introduced, and the rodents are making a real impact and a real dent in their populations because they actually go for the chicks. But anyway, so you start seeing pelagic species like giant petrels as well, which are these really gnarly, nasty-looking or mean-looking pirates or predators of the sea.
Those are the ones that eat meat, aren't they?
They do.
Oh,
yeah, they do.
Yeah.
But so there's really lots to see already. And then when you start getting closer to the mouth of the Beagle Channel, and as it starts to open up a little bit, what we see quite a lot of are dusky dolphins. Dolphins are quite interactive species, and if you're lucky, they come and they start getting very close to the vessel and they start bow riding, which is this really interesting phenomenon where the ship, as a very large thing sitting in the water, pushes quite a lot of water ahead of it and these waves, and this bow riding is just these dolphins that are surfing this wave, you know, highly intelligent creatures. Some of the most emotionally intelligent creatures on the planet, and it's having fun. Exactly,
so cute.
It's having fun, and they're just lovely animals that love to breach as well. They love to what we call porpoise, so almost their entire body comes out of the water, and it just makes for kind of excitement.
What a send-off.
It's a nice send-off. Yeah. It's excitement as
exciting.
It's very exciting as you're embarking on this incredible journey. And I must say that every time I'm in the Beagle Channel, leaving the Beagle Channel, I get excited. I've done it a few times now, but that excitement is always there because I really look forward to the Drake crossing. And I think that for most people, they remember the Drake crossing as a very positive experience. And I think that's what we should talk about now.
We'll go into kind of what's, you know, involved experientially on the Drake in terms of conditions and weather and all of that. But I think another factor is that the Drake is a really cool opportunity for people to learn a lot more about where they're going, what they're going to see, what they're looking out for, and what you're seeing on the Drake, just in terms of lectures.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
maybe just explain a little bit about like how the lectures work,
yeah,
especially on the Drake.
Yeah, exactly. So the Drake crossing takes 2 full days. That's kind of the minimum that it'll take to get down to the Shetland Islands, which are the islands that are just north of the Antarctic Peninsula. And during those 2 full days at sea, you have a couple of, you know, mandatory briefings that that happen, where, you know, the EL, the expedition leader, who is kind of the guide that is in charge of the guiding operations, he will go or she will go into detail about what leaving the ship is going to look like and what you should and should not do.
There are pretty strict parameters.
Yeah, there are strict parameters around, you know, like you're not allowed to sit down. You can't get too close to the animals, even if the animals sometimes want to get closer to you. But on top of that, there's an educational program where you have history lectures, you have birding lectures, you have geology and glaciology lectures, you have, what else is there? Photography, you have marine biology. So, you know, somebody talking about the different mammals that we might encounter or see on our expeditions and excursions while down there. And this fills the time while you're at sea, but it also gets you excited about what you might come across and encounter. And it just contextualizes or just like frames the trip really well. So you're going down and you start to have a bit of a base knowledge of what you might come across.
Yeah, what you might come across, what it is, like how to better identify it yourself. Also the like significant, I think there's sometimes history lectures also.
Yeah, definitely.
So
yeah.
Like the historical significance, which we kind of talked about in the last episodes, of like who's been where and who was the first people there and all that sort of stuff. One thing I think is really cool is that because the weather is not always the best, which I think we'll kind of talk on about conditions, there is an option where you can, if you're not feeling well and you want to stay in your room because you're not feeling great, you can listen to all of the lectures
your
room.
So the lectures, just as with kind of most cruise ships, there's like a main area, a main kind of auditorium or theater where there's a big projector or a big screen that the lecturers can put their lectures up on, and that gets streamed to the rooms, to the cabins where there's a TV, and you can tune in if you're not feeling as well. But I think let's address the elephant in the room, which is,
the seas,
the Drake Passage. We talked about it a little bit on the last episode. It is notoriously the most, it's kind of the most gnarly body of water in the world. I'm not going to say it's not, but I'm going to say that the vast majority of the time the crossings are totally fine. When you leave the lee of Cape Horn and the southern part of South America, Cape Horn being that most southerly point of South America, it's usually the nighttime. So it's usually, you know, around midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning. And
that's when, if there is swell, it starts picking up.
Exactly. You have a little bit of swell, when you're kind of in the lee of Cape Horn still, but then when you leave the lee, so when you leave that kind of
protected
piece of water, you start feeling it. And I usually kind of wake up during the night because I'm moving around a little bit in my bed, and I like that feeling because I know then that I'm in the Drake. And it makes me excited because I know that I'm going to wake up the next morning, there's not going to be land in sight, I'm going to go outside and I'm going to start seeing lots of different bird species. But yeah, the crossings, you know, they vary for sure. I've had what we call a Drake Lake, and then I've had what's called a Drake Shake. So Drake Lake being quite flat, calm conditions. It's definitely not normal to be completely flat. That would be strange. But it's also not normal for it to be like really, really nasty. The norm and the standard and the average, I would say, is between 3 and 4 meters. So between 10 and 12 feet or so. And you feel that like when you're walking around. But the vast majority of people don't get seasick. And I can say this confidently, you know, on our expedition team, there's maybe 1 in 20 people that get seasick on a crossing. And generally, if you don't get seasick at all, you're not going to get seasick when you go down there. There are obviously a few people who do. And I think that almost every guest who goes on these trips will take precautions.
Yeah.
There's also always a doctor. There are two doctors on board. There's a ship doctor and an expedition doctor, and they have what they call these sea clinics, where they kind of describe what the symptoms might be, and they also have medicine that they can give you.
I think I envision most people wear those like nausea bracelets.
People wear the bracelets.
And then the seasickness patches.
The seasickness patches, which make you go crazy. And then
some people probably take oral meds for seasickness as well.
Exactly. When I initially started on these trips, I was also a little concerned about that because I haven't spent that much time on the high seas. And I took the
Dramamine.
The, like Dramamine and things like that. What that does for me and for most
everyone.
People, for everyone, it makes you drowsy. I think the seas in general, because the motion of the ocean
rocking you
does
to sleep,
does
yeah.
make you drowsy. But you know, I find that I enjoy the crossings a lot more when I don't take the medicine. I'm not encouraging you if you go down there to do one or the other. It's totally up to you. But for me, it makes me drowsy and I can't enjoy the crossing as much. So yeah, I think just take that, you know, whichever way you want to take it. I think that the majority of people don't feel any seasickness symptoms.
There's a goldfinch building a nest outside the window.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you wake up on that first full sea day, you know, what I always recommend for people to do is to go outside first. That's,
I mean, seasickness wise, I'm sure that's the best. Get outside, get out in the air, look at the horizon. Well,
absolutely.
The horizon,
and I think most people do that. What most of the companies do down there is they provide people with a really nice outdoor parka. And there's two reasons for that. The first reason is it's good because we know that everybody's going to be wearing the same thing and be comfortably warm, because this jacket is usually a two-layer jacket with an inner liner and an outer protective shell. And that just keeps people warm when they go on these expeditions and they leave the ship. The second reason for that is that all the guests are the same color, and it stands out from the background. Usually, you know, they choose usually
bright yellow.
It's most companies
bright
choose
yellow, bright, red.
Bright colors that are stark contrast to the environment. And you know, I always recommend for guests to put on that jacket, go outside on that first day of the Drake, look around, take it all in. Because you know, the likelihood is that they haven't been on high seas like that before. Now, if the weather is really bad, which doesn't happen all that often, kind of happens a few times a season maybe, then they close the outer decks and you can't go outside, and that's just for safety. But if the seas are like what I've described, sort of 10 to 12 feet, you know, you're allowed outside, and there's usually good decks to walk around, and I can almost guarantee you that unless it is completely foggy on that first morning, if you go outside, you will see more than one species of albatross, and you will see several species of pelagic birds.
So cool.
One of my favorite things, honestly, is going outside on that first sea day. I usually do it before I have breakfast. You know, I might grab a cup of coffee and go outside with that. And I look around, and if I see like a wandering or southern royal albatross, I just love it. It's just so cool seeing these. What are the two largest?
I was gonna say, you gotta say how big they are.
They're the two largest flying bird species. They have the biggest wingspan, and
wandering albatross is what, 12 feet?
A wandering albatross is, you know, on average going to be between 3 and 3.2 meters, which is sort of 10 feet,
yeah,
10 to 11 feet. But they have been recorded up to 12 feet, and that is, if you look there, that's from
that's
the
right
hand side to the left hand side of that that wardrobe, that wall there. So masters of flight, they barely flap their wings ever. They do something
jumbo jets.
They do something called dynamic gliding or dynamic soaring, where they're using a combination of the wind and the waves in order to fly effortlessly. So they have these very specialized.
Did you say the waves?
Yeah, they actually use the waves. Oh. Yeah. So they have these very specialized tendons which snap into place when they lift their wings up and hold their wings in place. So it's causing them, there's no energy
to hold them.
Yeah, they're not expending any energy when they're flying to just lift their wings. And then they fly sort of at a 90 degree angle to the wind And we'll try and put up a little like diagram of what this looks like so that you can envision it better. But they fly in, when they fly into the wind, they're gaining in altitude or elevation, and they're also losing speed. That makes sense, right? Yeah. And then when they really lose speed, they make a 180 degree turn, and they turn around and they fly with the wind and down
the wave.
Down, often down the wave, exactly. And just before they touch the surface of the water, when they're flying fastest, they make another turn. And, you know, their wings are really almost touching the water. It is...
That's so cool.
It is amazing to see. And it's more amazing because of how big these birds are. But albatrosses, you know, it's a well-known species. It's an iconic species. They spend months and months at a time at sea. And that means...
They only go on land to breed.
They only go on land to breed, normally.
Mm-hmm.
And they feed on the surface of the water. So it's not to say that they don't sit down in the water to feed. They do that, but the vast majority of time they're going to spend flying.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah. So seeing those albatrosses and seeing those pelagic species like the giant petrels, the storm petrels, you know, the prions, it's for me one of my, as an avid kind of bird lover, it's one of my favorite things about the drake.
Yeah, I think what's also cool and what's something worth mentioning is that, you know, birding, if you aren't interested in birding, or if you are not a birder, you know, pre going down to Antarctica, pelagics are not the easiest to identify or to distinguish one from the other as a bird group. It's quite challenging. But the benefit is that you have someone like Jomi or on different ornithologist on, there's an ornithologist on every boat, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have an ornithologist on the boat who's out on the decks and is showing you this is this, that is that. And if you want to learn, this is the difference. And do you see how that one has a tiny little white line above its eyebrow? That's how we know it's this one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So then as the crossing progresses, it starts to get colder, obviously. And it's kind of punctuated, the crossing of the Drake is punctuated by the crossing of the Antarctic convergence or polar front, which we discussed on the last podcast episode, which is the ecological boundary of Antarctica. It's where the kind of the cold southern ocean meets the warmer kind of sub-Antarctic sea. And when you cross this convergence, you are often met with these big fog banks. But what also happens in these colder waters is that there is a lot more phytoplankton, a lot more phytoplankton blooms, and then you start getting into water where there are...
Do you happen to know why that is? Because that kind of doesn't... In my head, I'm like, phytoplankton would do well in warmer water.
Generally speaking, colder water is more nutritious, and a lot of this plankton actually grows on the underside of ice.
Oh, the icebergs, yeah. Right. So, and then they melt and it gets released in the krill.
Exactly, it gets released, and then you have these, there's a lot of light down there as well, so you have these phytoplankton blooms, which are then fed upon by
different
creatures, but krill and Antarctic krill
and
being
the
most abundant.
Come for that.
Exactly, and then you start seeing other marine life like whales and seals as well, and penguins, and you can see penguins on the open ocean in the middle of the Drake, which is just kind of
so cool.
Crazy to think that they swim out that far, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles from the nearest land. But what I do want to talk about just briefly is, you know, some of these whale congregations that you come across in the Drake. And last season I saw what was and still is for me the largest congregation of whales that I've ever seen, and I think for a lot of people who were on the ship at the time, including guides that had been there for many years or have worked down there for many years, for them one of the largest congregation of whales. And it was a congregation of fin whales and humpback whales together, and they had to be in that area because there was just a huge school of krill. So you're talking
how many whales?
Well, so you're talking about an area, call it the size of like 10 to 20 football fields. So a big area. But there must have been, and I'm always conservative in these guesses and guesstimations because I don't want to sound like I'm exaggerating. You know, it's something that people have the habit of doing, and I don't like doing it because I always think, ah, no, that can't be real. So I'm being conservative in this guess. I think it was between 50 and 100 whales in one area together. And from a distance, what you're seeing is the whale spout, sort of that breath that it releases. Yeah, exactly, like a geyser that comes up over the surface of the water. Fin whales are the second largest whales. They can grow up to 25 meters long. So that's, you know, 75, 80 feet long.
Is the video, that beautiful video you have of the whale and like the really clear water coming up, is that a fin whale?
No, that's a minke whale.
Oh. Also
but
beautiful.
Also
big.
Beautiful, yeah. But this sighting was, you know, we were on the ship in the Drake. So we're not getting off the ship. You don't get off the ship in the Drake. You stay on the ship. But it was sort of this kind of these blows of these whales were kind of backlit a little bit so you could really clearly make them out. And I'll try put up a video of this, but it was just half an hour of us watching this massive congregation of whales feeding. They were quite far away in the distance, you know, because you're on the ship, you're not trying to disturb them, especially when they are feeding. But just totally amazing to see 50 to 100 of some of the largest creatures, not only on the planet currently, but that have ever existed on the planet together like that.
Also kind of incredible that you could have so easily missed that. You know, you're in this enormous, enormous body of water to, like, the luck and the happenstance of getting to see that must feel so special.
It is special. And, you know, I think, look, the whales largely migrate between, and I'm going to get into this a little bit more in future episodes, but they migrate between warmer equatorial water where they breed, especially the humpbacks, which is the largest population of whales, down to the Antarctic for feeding, which are their main feeding grounds. So they often also follow a similar route to the ship because they not always, but let's call it a thoroughfare. You know, because it's the quickest distance or the shortest distance between the South America and Antarctica. But on that day, you know, we were lucky to see them because it was a pretty calm day. You know, it was very calm, actually. And visibility can be a limiting factor. So it's not just if there are big waves, but it's also if the tops of the waves are these white caps, because then it's hard, or it's sometimes easy to kind of mistake those white caps for the blows of whales, and you're not necessarily seeing the body of the whales but just the blows. But overall, it was just like it was just something to witness, you know. It was one of, for me, a very, very special scene. I think on that note, that's kind of, you know, that's generally speaking how the Drake crossings go. What you do start seeing south of the convergence also are icebergs, and you know, it's smaller fragments or pieces of ice that have broken off from the ice shelves or from the mainland, or that are glaciers that have calved. But you start seeing that, a lot more marine life, and then the next thing that you see is land. And I think we're gonna describe in the next episode. And we hope that you enjoyed this episode, but yeah, join us the next time because we're going to start talking about what it's like leaving the ship when
South
you go
Shetlands?
Yep, the South Shetlands, when you go on an Antarctic expedition.
Amazing.